This is time set for argument on our first matter, Muscle Farm Corp. versus White Winston, docket number 79163. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, and would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. If permissible, I would reserve 5 minutes of time.
All right, that's fine. You can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, Gavin Shriver of Caswitz, Benson, Torres, on behalf of the petitioners who are the defendants below. First, I did want to thank the Court for permitting me to argue remotely today. We obviously all find ourselves under difficult circumstances, so being permitted to argue remotely is greatly appreciated. If at any point anybody can't hear me, please let me know and I'll be happy to speak up. I am speaking through the phone. I'm happy to provide a brief summary of this appeal to begin with. But the underlying case here is a shareholder derivative suit against the directors of a Nevada corporation, Muscle Farm, by a hedge fund named White Winston. Now, a few weeks after the case was filed, White Winston sought expedited discovery into another litigation that was pending against Muscle Farm, its CEO, Ryan Drexler, and nearly three dozen others by Mr. Drexler's brother-in-law, Bradford Billet, relating to a matrimonial dispute. Now, at the time, White Winston claimed that it was concerned that Mr. Billet's litigation posed such an existential threat to Muscle Farm that a receiver should be appointed to protect the company against that litigation. Now, here's what they said at the time. They said that the lawsuit itself, quote, poses a serious danger of waste, sacrifice, and or loss of the company's assets. That's page 106 of petitioner's appendix. They said that, quote, to the extent Muscle Farm is found to be a co-conspirator of the Drexler family, it faces in excess of $125 million of liability under RICO. In short, Muscle Farm faces significant risk of litigation that will lead to loss and waste of the company's assets. That's page 171 of our appendix. Now, as it turns out, notwithstanding their claim that they were trying to protect the company against this serious litigation risk through an anticipated receivership motion, White Winston had already been in close communication with Mr. Billet about that same litigation. So close that when we sought discovery into those communications, White Winston responded that it shared a common interest with Mr. Billet. And I submit to the Court that this makes no sense. On the one hand, White Winston says it's trying to protect the company from a serious litigation risk posed by Mr. Billet and his litigation. On the other hand, White Winston says it's sharing legal strategies with Mr. Billet. To what end, it's unclear, but presumably to help Mr. Billet succeed in his litigation against the company.
Mr. Shriver, before you get too far into your discussion of common interest and other privilege issues, I'd like you to address the district court's analysis and conclusion that the discovery sought by you folks is not relevant.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I apologize, I interrupted. Absolutely, Your Honor. We don't view this as a close call on relevance. First, the standard used by the court below was simply incorrect. The court held that it must determine that discovery is relevant before that discovery is ordered. But that's not the standard. Citing identical language in Federal Rule 26, the federal courts are clear that discovery is permitted into any matter that may be relevant. And of course, this court is the final arbiter of what Nevada Rule 26 means. And it has the power to decide that the is relevant is the requirement, that a court must find that discovery is relevant, not just that the topics the discovery sought may be relevant, may lead to the discovery of relevant evidence, is the appropriate standard. But I respectfully submit that if that's the standard that this court uses for Nevada, it should do so expressly, intentionally, carefully, because that would be setting a very different standard for discovery than that applicable to the identical Federal Rule 26. And I also submit it would be vastly curtailing the scope of discovery in the state from what it currently is and what practitioners currently follow. But also important, I think, regardless of what standard is used, it was satisfying. The White Winston's collaboration with Mr. Billett is indisputably relevant to petitioner's unclean hands defense. And to be clear, no one disputes that we would need to show that White Winston acted inequitably in connection with this very litigation. That's what this court said in Las Vegas Fetish. I believe it's in other cases. That's not a standard we dispute. It's a standard that's met here. Because White Winston is working together with Mr. Billett in connection with this case to bring about the very result it's been claiming in this case that this court necessitates a receiver. So to us, not only is that the definition of unclean hand, but it relates directly to what White Winston is doing in this case. White Winston would not have done any of these things. Wouldn't have had these communications with Mr. Billett at all if it weren't for this case. So to us, the material is clearly relevant.
Mr. Shriver, this is Justice Kadish in Las Vegas.
Good morning.
As to the standard for discovery under our revised 26B1, which I believe is what you were referring to, it says explicitly parties may obtain discovery regarding any non-privileged matter that is relevant to any party's claims or defenses, and then it goes on with proportionality. So I thought you were trying to argue whether it should be is relevant or may be relevant, but it seems to me the language of the rule says is relevant, so that's the standard. Are you arguing for a different standard than that?
What I'm arguing for is what the courts and the federal courts have done, which is provide a very broad interpretation of that argument. So, for example, as a Nevada district court said, the relevancy requirement, and it's referring to that is relevant language, has been construed broadly to encompass any matter that bears on or that reasonably could lead to other matter that could bear on any issue that is or may be in the case. And other courts have said similarly and used a standard of, in order to seek discovery, in order to obtain discovery, it merely has to reasonably lead to material that would be relevant. And that's different than what the court did here, which is say, okay, are these documents going to be relevant, yes or no, or is it possible that they're going to be relevant? So I think that what I'm arguing for here is a broad interpretation of that language and a similarly broad interpretation the federal courts have given identical language.
That sounds like it's going back to the old language, which was reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, which I thought we rejected in moving on to this language. Is that what's your understanding about that?
And then I'll confess I don't have a detailed understanding of the legislative history of these particular federal rules, of the Nevada rule, I should say. But Nevada federal courts have been consistent, and that continues to the present date, in interpreting the rules, which are still identical with moderate, minor wordsmithing changes to the federal rules as to what is the proper standard. Federal courts are continuing to give this broad interpretation. But again, I would also go back and say that regardless of the standard, I don't see how these documents are not relevant. Maybe, is, could be, will be, doesn't really matter. Either these documents are relevant or they're not, frankly. If this court agrees with our interpretation of what unclean hands means, what unclean hands could be, then these documents are the most relevant documents that exist on our defense. If the court disagrees with us on unclean hands, then suppose these documents aren't relevant because we don't have such a defense. But it really is, I think of the standard, but it really is an application here in particular. But it does appear to me that the court viewed this in a much more narrow framework, narrow interpretation than it should have.
Well, I understand your argument, Mr. Shriver, but what you haven't addressed is the district court's conclusion on the relevancy question, whether this was, as Justice Kadish has pointed out, the language change was a change. And it seems to suggest to district court judges that in making the assessment, they are to determine whether the information is relevant at this stage. Assuming that that is the approach taken by the rule change, I wanted you to articulate why the unclean hand, why this information is relevant to the unclean hands defense. The district court said that it wasn't, and it was pointing to the unclean hand defense elements articulated in Las Vegas Fetish.
So, Your Honor, here what we have is White Winston, who is an investor in Multiform, coming to the court, and they did this in almost 2 years ago now, and said, we anticipate moving for a receiver, which is a highly equitable relief, obviously, and on the grounds, a couple grounds, and one of those grounds was the existence of this lawsuit. And in particular, as the language I quoted earlier indicates, particular the danger that this lawsuit poses to the company. Now, if they are attempting to seek this equitable relief of a receiver, and at the same time work in order to defend the company against the harms from this lawsuit, at the same time working in the background to help the plaintiff in that lawsuit with his claims, I think that's highly relevant. That's highly dispositive, even, of the fact that White Winston has unclean hands. One cannot go to a court and seek relief when they are against the danger that they are bringing about.
Well, wait a minute. The issue isn't whether it's relevant to that. It's question is whether it's relevant to the elements of unclean hands. The question here is whether or not White Winston's conduct is egregious in its communication with the billet folks and the seriousness of the harm caused by that misconduct. I don't hear you addressing the elements of the unclean hands doctrine.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we believe that, and we submit respectfully.
So let me just add one more question to this point. From White Winston's perspective, as you noted earlier in your argument, they are concerned about the financial impact on Muscle Farm related to the outcome of the billet and other New York litigation and how that could impact the financial condition of the company. But why White Winston as a shareholder in Muscle Farm also be concerned that there's been this promissory note transaction that's allegedly fraudulent that also potentially impairs the financial condition, and a receiver should be fighting that?
Well, I think we need to parse that out a bit, because the note that Mr. Grexler entered into in 2017 was a refinancing of money that had been provided over the course of 2 years before that. And the allegation by Mr. Billet, of course, is that the money that was provided 2 years before this was obtained from his marital estate. The actual transaction that's being challenged in the merits of the case that is still pending below relates to this refinance. It challenges the terms, the new convertible rate on that refinancing in 2017. It doesn't challenge the initial investment in 2016, 2017, I believe it's 2018. So those are disconnected. It's only focused on, their claims only focused on the 2017 refinancing. I think I got the dates all wrong there, I apologize. But they're two separate sets of transactions. So I think what you may be asking, Your Honor, is, doesn't White Winston have a fair interest into whether Mr. Grexler invested money that he obtained from him? And I won't dispute that they do. But the fact that doesn't... there's a difference between asking...
But isn't that the point the district court was getting to in its determination of relevance? How is White Winston's behavior egregious misconduct under the first element of unclean hands? That's what I'm trying to understand.
And I think something that's really important here is we don't know what was said. What appears is that they were sharing legal strategies. If they were sharing legal strategies to help Mr. Billet, that's very different than asking Mr. Billet, hey, what's the basis for this? We'd like to know if our CEO did these things. Could you tell us? And frankly, that if that was the statement, that couldn't possibly be privileged. There's no common interest when you ask someone on the phone, hey, could you tell me what's the basis for this? When they say there's a common interest, when they say they're sharing legal strategies, it doesn't pass the smell test. And I think it's important to look at a case that White Winston cited in their brief. It's Rogan versus Commercial Union out of the Seventh Circuit, and it talked about, and they cite this case as saying that a naked claim of bad faith cannot authorize a fishing expedition into privileged communication. So we're even talking about privileged communication. But what the court said is the plaintiff must demonstrate some likelihood or probability that the document sought may contain evidence of bad faith. Of course, this required showing is not a high hurdle because the plaintiff, without seeing the documents, can only speculate as to their likely contents. He need only show the possibility, not the certainty, that the documents contain evidence of bad faith. Here, that's precisely the case. Because they're not letting us see it, we can only speculate.
All right, Mr. Shriver, you've actually chewed up your rebuttal time, but since we asked you quite a few questions, I'm going to give you 2 minutes additional for rebuttal, and I'll extend that 2 minutes also to Ms. Gall. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is the court ready for my opposition argument?
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Maria Gall of Ballard Spahr for the Real Parties in Interest, plaintiffs below, who I may refer to collectively as White Winston throughout this argument. Your Honors, this case is about when a court will protect communications with an attorney and that attorney's papers. Judge Russell below entered a very extensive protective order, protecting not only my communications with Bradford Villa's attorney, but also my work papers, which include my communications with my colleagues, as well as my communications with my own client. This court, in its order directing an answer from us, asked whether this case was one that merited writ relief and this court's extraordinary intervention. We submit it does not. It does not concern a district court order compelling the production of potentially privileged information. Petitioners have a remedy in the ordinary course of an appeal. It also, perhaps more importantly, Your Honors, does not concern an issue of first impression, but rather the application of the statutory common interest privilege and Cotter's gloss on what constitutes a common interest. True, Cotter concerned the application of the common interest rule to an extension of the work product doctrine and an exception to that doctrine, but there is no reason, Your Honors, that a different common interest rule should exist for the common interest privilege, which by definition as a privilege is more protective than the work product doctrine. Now, in their reply, petitioners are...
I'm not so sure, counsel, that your contention that this isn't an issue of first impression is accurate. We have not defined common interest for purposes of the privilege under Chapter 49. Have we?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I also would submit, Your Honor, that the rule announced in Cotter would apply with equal force to that. But I certainly won't debate the point with Your Honor. If he considers this an issue of first impression, that is squarely within Your Honor's and this court's purview.
Well, I'm asking for your input on this, and I hope counsel will comment as well, but there is a considerable amount of conflict in the jurisprudence and the history behind the rule and the statute as to how we should, how expansive we should view the common interest privilege, or the term common interest for purposes of the privilege. So I'd like to hear from you, and perhaps Mr. Shriver could also comment as to how broad or narrow we should consider that common interest, because that was a key component of the district court's assessment of this matter. So I'd like you to get into that, if you would, please. It seems like there's competing positions in the restatement and in the history behind the adoption of the applicable section of Chapter 49.
Understood, Your Honor. For that, let me go over to Cotter, because I think this court's precedent is important here. And as your honors, I'm sure you're familiar with Cotter, the court defined the common interest there to exist, the common interest rule and supposed existence of the common interest to be where two parties anticipate litigation on the against a common adversary on the same issue or issues. And so the court did not use, for instance, the petitioner's preferred language of identical issue or issues. They said the same issue or issues, and then the court actually went on to say that Cotter and the intervening plaintiffs in Cotter, so the two common interest parties there, were proceeding on similar issues of breach of fiduciary duty, but certainly not identical issues, which is what I think here the standard the petitioners would like for this court to adopt by citing to various federal case law that at least superficially uses an identity of interest or identical claims language. But Your Honor, we would submit that, first of all, the case law, and we put this in our papers, the case law cited by petitioners, when you really dig into those cases, even those cases, petitioner side, do not require a complete identity of clients and a complete identity of interests. And then when you look at, Your Honors, the cases we cite, including the cases relied on by Cotter, such as, for instance, U.S. versus AT&T, you see federal courts adopting a common interest rule where the parties are not completely aligned. For instance, in the AT&T case, the court said that the government and MCI share a common interest in the sense that they are proceeding on overlapping antitrust issues against the common
I'd like you to comment, if you would, while you're on that point, as an example. The Phase 2 Chin versus Forum Shops Federal District Court case, where the court says the elements of the common interest privilege require that both parties' interests are identical, not similar, that the common interest is legal, not solely commercial, and that the communication is shared with the attorney of the member of the community interest. It seems like the first two prongs of that test used in that case are of an example, I think, of what many of the federal courts are using to approach this question with.
Understood, Your Honor, and I will address that. First of all, I'd like to point out that in Phase 2 Chin, the court also went on to say that it is not necessary that the parties have a common legal interest or strategy in regard to all matters in dispute or transaction. So I think we have to look at their language, that the interests be identical within the context of that language here. And here, if you apply even Chin's requirement that the interests at issue be identical, I think we have that here, Your Honor, because we are both...
How so? What is it that is the identical interest in this case?
Both we and Bradford Billet are litigating the issue of Brian Drexler's transfer of monies to Muscle Farm, the $18 million transfer to Muscle Farm. Bradford Billet is seeking to disgorge or unwind those monies through the traditional claim of a fraudulent transfer, the remedy of a fraudulent transfer. We are seeking to have those monies disgorged and taken out of Muscle Farm through the appointment of a receiver. But the interest in proving that that transfer was in fact fraudulent is one that we share. And I think it's one that Judge Russell really got to during oral argument below, where he asked Mr. Kasowitz, who at that time was arguing for the petitioners, you know, hey, but look, aren't there fraudulent transfer claims in both cases? And Mr. Kasowitz admitted that there were. So, Your Honor, that is the common legal interest that we share. As far as the second sort of element element that Chin set forth, whether the interest has to be legal or commercial. Your Honor, first of all, I don't think that's at issue in this case. I don't think we're debating whether or not our claimed interest with Billet is commercial as opposed to legal. But I think, Your Honors, the NRS 49.095 actually answers that question, because if you look at the plain language of the statute, it says under subsection 3 that the communication has to be made for the purpose of facilitating the rendition of professional legal services. So I would say the interest share would have to be legal under Chin. As for the third element, whether
Ms. Gall,
has to, yes.
Sorry, can I hold you up for just a second, Justice
sure.
Kadish here? So Mr. Shriver said that in the motion seeking the appointment of the receiver, that the motion was describing this suit by Billet as, you know, an existential threat to the company, and here your clients are shareholders and are seeking a receiver to help preserve its assets. I think he's trying to say that you have adverse interest, and that your description seemed to say you have adverse interest. So how does that square with having a common interest?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I think Mr. Shriver has misrepresented exactly how our papers were presented to the lower court. Yes, we did mention that the Billet case, is a threat to the company, especially if Bradford Billet is successful in proving his RICO claim. But, Your Honor, I don't think the fact that Mr. Billet is proceeding on a RICO claim that seeks $129 million in damages excludes that we have a common interest on the fraudulent, on the underlying and the basic fraudulent transfer issue of the $18 million in the first instance. And I think, and certainly I don't want to put words into Justice Hardesty's mouth, but I think this is what Justice Hardesty was getting at when he mentioned that, you know, just because we may have adverse interests in some regard, and I am not conceding that we have adverse interests in some regard, we certainly appear at least to have a common interest with regard to the fraudulent transfer and the $18 million transaction.
Well,
so
go ahead, Justice Kadish.
Okay, sorry. If in fact it's found to be a fraudulent transfer, that would require the company to disgorge the money that was fraudulently transferred to it, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And on that, go ahead, Your Honor, I apologize.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead and expand on your answer.
I was going to say the $18 million, Your Honor, if it's found to be a fraudulent transfer, I would submit that doesn't harm the company in the sense that the company owes somebody $18 million. It either owes it to Mr. Drexler, or if it's found to be a fraudulent transfer, it owes it to Bradford Billet through the unwinding of the fraudulent transfer process. And so I'm not even sure how that would constitute a harm to the company itself.
Thank you.
I think the point I was trying to make is Mr. Shriver indicated that the overarching goals here, Mr. Billet seeks to destroy Muscle Farm with his lawsuit, and you're trying to protect Muscle Farm by appointing a receiver. Therefore, the overall interest is adverse, is I think what Mr. Shriver was trying to say earlier.
I would agree that that's how I would also characterize his argument, Your Honor, and I'm not sure if you wanted me to comment on that.
I do.
Clarify a little bit on our position. But first of all, I would say that the characterization of Mr. Billet trying to destroy Muscle Farm, I think that's a little bit based in histrionics and a little bit based on speculation. I think what Mr. Billet is trying to do is he's trying to get his money back at the end of the day. And I think our interests are aligned with Mr. Billet in the sense that as investors in Muscle Farm, we do not want to be invested in a company that has fraudulently transferred sums in it and that has been used, as we've alleged, as a money laundering vehicle. And so I would, while I agree that's Mr. Shriver's characterization, I would certainly disagree with the point that that somehow creates adverse interest between us and Mr. Billett.
So, counsel, in more simplistic terms, is the goal of your receivership action to make sure that the corporation pays the right person back?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that was in our papers below, is that our goal is to get these $18 million if it was, in fact, fraudulently transferred, a matter which we agree it hasn't been established yet, but if, in fact, it has been fraudulently transferred and that is what the discovery and the evidence shows, then we would like a receiver to be able to disgorge those funds and get those funds back to its rightful owner, whoever that might be.
Would you comment on the relevancy question that we used so much of Mr. Shriver's time to discuss?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor seems very familiar with the court's own case of Las Vegas Fetish and Fantasy, and I think 2 points on that. One, Judge Russell, in his discretion, looking at the record, and also the judge who's ultimately going to be controlling whether a receiver is appointed, at least in the first instance, unless it's appealed, said that the success or failure of the Billett action is not relevant to the unclean hands defense. And by extension, it's not relevant to the appointment of a receiver. I think Judge Russell here has indicated he's just not going to appoint a receiver on whether or not the Billett action succeeds or fails. And I would submit, Your Honor, that's in part because I don't think 78.650, the main receivership statute here, even allows for the appointment of a receiver based on the success or failure of a separate lawsuit. So I think, Your Honor, Judge Russell was getting, to that point when he said and he held, look, White Winston here, they're not intending to base their receivership application on the success or failure of Billett. And,
let me refine my question a little bit. On page 12 and 13 of his order on reconsideration, he's assessing relevancy. The judge did not reference the amendments to the rules of civil procedure, which I think changed Nevada's approach to 26. But it appears as though his analysis is consistent with that rule change. Mr. Shriver argues, no, that's not the case. Even though the rule change was made, we should still focus on whether or not the information is going to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, which was the older standard. That's what I'd like to ask you to comment about, if Justice Perry-Gary would add a little bit of time for you to answer that question.
Yes, I will. Let's give you an additional 2 minutes, and Mr. Shriver, you'll have an additional 2 minutes as well.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I do think, Justice Hardesty, that is what Judge Russell was driving at. The rule change was seminal. It was seminal when the federal court made the rule change and when Justice Roberts commented that we never intended for the language likely to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence to lead essentially to a fishing expedition when something wasn't relevant at all to the claims and defenses that were made. And that's really was really commentary and language for purposes of saying that it went to the evidentiary standard, Your Honor. I won't devolve too far into that. But here, I think what Judge Russell did is he looked at the plain language of Rule 26, this court's rule, which says that the discovery, you can discover stuff that is relevant. And I think he also looked at this court's holding in the Sonia F. case, where in commenting on the scope of Rule 26, this court said the discovery must be relevant. And those words, Your Honor, I think signal what's in the rule change and what was codified in the rule change is that you cannot embark on some type of fishing expedition just because you think that bad faith may be out there. The discovery has to be relevant. And here, what Judge Russell has decided in looking at Las Vegas fetish and fantasy is that the unclean hands defense, properly understood, is just not applicable here in the way and under the structure that petitioners would like it to be. And so for that reason, he alternatively or additionally denied the discovery on the basis of relevancy.
Thank you.
I think I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Okay, Mr. Shriver.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'd like to focus my remaining time on the common interest issues. And I think the papers that were submitted to the court below by Wright Winston speak for themselves. For example, you know, there was a lot of discussion by counsel for Wright Winston that they don't really care either way about what happens to the money. But here's what they actually said to the court. The company faces serious litigation risk, as it could be deemed a fraudulent transferee resulting in disgorgement of Muscle Farm assets. That's pages 109 to 110 of the appendix. Those are the words of White Winston's counsel. So we have to some extent, rely on White Winston's counsel and the truth of their words as to what they believe might happen and might be the risk. Now, I think what happened here, there's been a conflation of issues and interests. The common interest privilege relates to common interests, not common issues. The fact that we might have an issue in common doesn't mean we have a common interest and privilege. In fact, White Winston and the company have a common issue, which is the 2017 refinancing, which is the heart of the case below. We disagree on that issue, right? Our interests in that issue are directly adverse. The issue is exact same. And so while it is true that Mr. Billett and White Winston may share, have an issue in common between them, their interests in that issue are completely different. Mr. Billett wants this money to come back to him, not that it ever came to him. And by the way, that Mr. Billett's action has actually been dismissed with prejudice, but wants that money to come back to him from the company. White Winston does not. Now, they now claim they want disgorgement through this receivership proposal, but nowhere in their papers below have I seen that. And when they asked for discovery back in September of 2018, they didn't say, we want to disgorge this money back to Mr. Billett through receiver. They said disgorgement was the risk they're trying to avoid. So, you know, while maybe they sit here today, they refined their approach, they've refined their interest. Maybe right now they actually, if they were talking to Mr. Billett, they would have a common interest.
Can I ask you a question in that regard? The judge had an interesting statement in his order on page 7, in paragraph 17. Here there's no dispute. The stockholders and Billett are each litigating the issue of whether Drexler fraudulently transferred his sister's cash and her other assets to Muscle Farm. And to the extent it matters, they each seek the same result, a way to properly and legally address the disposition of any fraudulently transferred funds. How do you reconcile that statement, or you just disagree with that?
Well, two things. I do disagree with it. Again, that paragraph was drafted by White Winston, and I just don't think it's consistent with the record. There is no fraudulent conveyance claim that White Winston has asserted against Muscle Farm or any of its directors relating to Mr. Billett's allegations. There is none. Not one. So for them to say that we are seeking to disgorge this money, no, what they're seeking is a receivership. They haven't filed this motion. They've called it an anticipated motion for the past couple years. But this anticipated motion seeks a receivership to protect the company, not to disgorge assets, not to hand them out to anyone, or at least...
Wouldn't it protect the company to disgorge ill-gotten gains if, in fact, that's what they are?
The company doesn't have $18 million, so I'm not sure how it would disgorge the money. That would potentially end the company.
Well, I don't know either, but should a shareholder just say that's okay if that's what happened?
Absolutely not. And again, we don't contest White Winston's, and it didn't happen, but we don't contest White Winston's right to investigate. But that right to investigate doesn't give them a common interest with the person who's trying to pursue those claims and destroy the company through those claims.
All right, very good. Counsel, we appreciate your briefs and your argument and your time today. Colleagues, do either one of you have any additional question for either counsel?
I'm sorry, I know we've gone long. I just have one, I think, quick question for Mr. Shriver,
okay.
If that's okay.
Sure, of course.
Thank you. The district court order on page 5, paragraph 11, says the parties agree that if the stockholders and Billet share a common interest, then Nevada's common interest privilege protects all documents and communications at issue. Mr. Shriver, do you agree with that statement, that that's the heart of it, that if in fact there's a common interest, then all the documents and communications at issue are protected?
If there is a legally cognizable common interest under the statute,
right,
and the communications are as represented, which is simply communications between the two councils, then yes.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, colleagues?
Not for me.
All right. Very
thank
good.
You,
counsel, thank you again. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess while we reconstitute for the next panel.